Well, hello there, and thank you so much for joining us today. I hope that wherever you are and wherever the weather is at in your region, that you are enjoying sunshine and warmth and laughter in your day. I wanted to provide a brief introduction to the work that was revealed in our discussion with Z. Nicolazzo. Z is just an amazing human being, and I have been privileged and honored to be in community with Z, even if it is mostly on social media. I think Z just brings a lot of love and light to the world, and so I'm grateful for everything that we talked about and everything that Z really embodies on a daily basis. Some of the highlights to look forward to in this episode are thinking about the primary goal of public engagement and service as professionals enacting the vision and mission of our institutions. And what does that mean for our communities? Are they better because of their interaction with university professionals and college professionals? What is that impact on them? So Z really talks about centering that in her work. Z currently is really engaged in a couple of different areas of work and inquiry that I think listeners will really, really enjoy hearing about and centering in their day. The first is this idea of cultural discourses about gender and how they have an asymmetrical impact on transgender people in higher education. Z is also really interested in looking into how we conduct research and how we think about those research methodologies and epistemologies. And I love it because Z really breaks that language down. And Z is looking at research methodologies and epistemologies that are trans-infused. So if you're curious about what that means, you know, listen in on this episode to find out. We also talked about kinship networks in this episode, and Z really provided a deeper understanding of how this has shown up in research about community on college campuses and navigating experience as transgender people and queer folks on college campuses. So tune in for more information about that. So Z concludes our interview by asking a really powerful question. She asks, "What are you willing to give up for justice?" So if you're interested in knowing more about the context around that and how we can situate that question within the context of higher education environments and being professionals and folks that are representatives of these institutions, really tune in. That is at the conclusion of our time together. Z really just drops a lot of brilliance and breaks down language into its simplest form, yet she simultaneously points to how complex it is, how fluid language is, and how it influences our daily practice serving students. So this episode is jam-packed. You may have to rewind it a couple of times just to capture some of those brilliant nuggets of wisdom that Z drops, and they just happen so quickly, and she's so humble and calm about it that you really wouldn't think that something profound just happened. But I guarantee you it did. So enjoy this episode. I will get out of your way for now. I hope that you have an absolutely wonderful day. Welcome to the Resilient Campus Podcast, amplifying the voices of college inclusion innovators. I'm your host, Sabby Labor, founder and CEO of Resilient Campus. Join me each week as I interview professionals on the front lines of campus and community movement building. For more information, please visit resilientcampus.com/podcast. This is episode number 14 of the Resilient Campus Podcast. Today, we are humbled to be speaking with Z. Nicolazzo. Z is an assistant professor in the Adult and Higher Education Program and a faculty associate in the Center for the Study of Women, Gender, and Sexuality, both at Northern Illinois University. Z's first book is titled Trans in College: Transgender Student Strategies for Navigating Campus Life and the Institutional Politics of Inclusion. When Z isn't working, she enjoys cycling, watching Liverpool, her favorite English football team, and cuddling with her 11-year-old Westie, Gertrude. Z, thank you so much for being here. I'm really excited, and you look fabulous as usual. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I knew that I needed to bring my A game, right? So, I'm thrilled to be here.
Wonderful. And so, you know, we kind of have a core set of questions that we go with, but I mean, one, I would just love for people to hear what is at the top of mind for you in terms of how you're feeling, others need to know about you, know of you. Who are you? Introduce yourself.
Yeah, that's a good question. I often feel like academic bios are really stuffy, and so that's why I kind of added some like other types of highlights from my life,
I
right?
love it.
I think a lot of people, I've been really fortunate to, be able to write this fantastic book and work with wonderful trans youth, and I know that we're going to talk more about that, but one of the things I've found in talking more about my book and going to some conferences is people focus on me as my work and see those two things as synonymous rather than thinking about me being a whole person with lots of other things going on. So, whenever people say, "Tell me about yourself, who are you?" Right? I usually try and add some of those other kinds of silly things in, right? So, like, I have a great dog who, is wonderful and is sleeping under my desk right now as we talk. I am so thankful for this better weather in the Midwest now so that I can get out on my bike. I think too that I also am someone who, and I think this informs the research that I do, is intensely dedicated to my community and to my people and to my family. And I think about family kind of broadly speaking. For all the fans of astrology out there, I'm a Taurus, right? So deeply loyal. But also, this is it informs the work that I do and the way that I think about practice in student affairs as well.
I love that. I think, one of the things that I've come to realize is no matter, if we resist the stuffy academic bio, any bio that I produce, it just always feels awkward to have it read about you. And I don't know if that's a shared experience. What do you think?
Yes, totally. We were just chatting before we started recording, right, about like the use of the honorific doctor, right? And like it always feels a little kind of weird, and I always feel a little self-conscious, even if I'm the person who writes it and gives it to people, right? So I think this question about like who are you, right, is one that's always expanding and always kind of shifting for me. And I think that we do sometimes because we have to various different code switching, right, for different audiences and to be heard in different types of ways. I feel you about the bio thing.
Yeah, thanks for having my back there.
Yeah.
So tell us which identities are really salient for you today in this moment, in this minute as we talk.
Yeah. So for me, being trans is one of the most salient identities that I have, not just in terms of my work, but in terms of how I experience my life. In particular, being feminine of center, trans femme, is something that's really important to me, something that I think about consistently, whether it's something that is read or not read on my body by other people. I've been thinking a lot about race over the last couple of years as well, race and ethnicity. I was listening to a recent podcast. I'm not sure if you listened to. I think it was Code Switch, was the podcast that I was listening to, and they did an episode about Judaism, and they were talking about is being Jewish an ethnicity or a racial identity, right? Like all these kinds of
Interesting.
things, and so or a ethnicity or a faith. And so, as someone who identifies as ethnically Jewish, right, that was kind of interesting to think through. And in particular, I think a lot about my whiteness and how my whiteness actually mediates my experience as a trans person, and opens up different types of possibilities for me that trans people of color, specifically trans women of color, right, don't have opportunities towards. And I think the other thing that is particularly salient for me at this moment is thinking about disability. So recently I was diagnosed with depression and anxiety, have started taking some medication, and it's just been kind of a unique process for me to think about becoming enmeshed in the medical industrial complex in this particular kind of way, and to really think about this notion of dependency, which I know that we'll talk about later on, right? And not shying away from dependency, but seeing this as a strength and an asset.
I appreciate you sharing that. I think that I know that in my experience, we haven't had enough conversations in the field, whether the field is broadly higher education or whether we're looking at, folks that are in academic and faculty roles, or on student affairs side. This role of depression, anxiety, mental health, I think it's coming up as a topic more often, but I just think not enough. And I've really been humbled. A new person in my life this last year has been Sinclair Caesar, who was on the podcast. And Sinclair's just been, you know, just trying to uplift and at the same time be real about the issues that mental health expose an individual to on a daily basis, the additional, you know, layers of experience that and kind of the lens that they are looking through on a day-to-day basis. And so I've appreciated just being in relationship with Sinclair and folks like yourself, like saying, this is what's going on and we need to talk about it more. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So I know a little bit about the work. I honestly, I feel like I maybe know about 7% of the work that you're currently involved in. And I probably know 7% about, you know, who you are and what your interests are and thinking about your whole self, right? And so I'm loving learning more. And I think that people listening in would also love to know what you're sharing, to hear your sharing about what you're involved in today, whether you feel like it's formally work, or just like how you're embodying your daily existence and mm-hmm. kind of the work that takes on, right? We can't opt yeah. out of that as well. So tell us about what you're excited about today, what you're moving forward, what are you thinking about and doing?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, this is actually a really good time, I think, to do this podcast because I just submitted my third year review materials. So it's basically like a halfway point through the tenure process where I get to reflect on everything that I've done and try and do some sense making about the body of my work rather than kind of individual or discrete pieces. And so it's really, I think, forced me to be reflective about what am I trying to do kind of through this project, right, through my research agenda, and how am I trying to kind of exist both within and outside the academy. And so, you know, broadly speaking, my work is focused on cultural discourses of gender. And so when I say discourses, I'm thinking about like big D discourses about like the written and unwritten rules, right? So people who are familiar with probably more K through 12 education might be familiar with notions of the hidden curriculum. So they're not actually written down rules, but they're still kind of these implicit notions about what constitutes quote unquote appropriate or inappropriate gender, presentation, expression, identity, and thinking about how those discourses mediate certainly everybody's lives, but have a asymmetrical effect on trans people and gender nonconforming people in higher education. Mm. So I'm thinking about various different policies, various different practices, various different locations on college campuses. So I've done some work thinking about LGBT centers. I've done some work thinking about academic programs and how gender is kind of always there and how it really right, mediates students' experiences. I'm also doing a little bit of thinking, particularly with some colleagues around kind of expanding notions of research methodologies as well as epistemologies or ways of coming to know that are particularly influenced by gender and specifically trans ways of knowing. Mm-hmm. And so that for me becomes, I think, really important because it's not just the knowledge about trans people that we need to be thinking about, but it's how we actually come to that knowledge. I teach a number of research methodology classes in my program. And one of the things that I constantly am telling students is that it's not just about right the end result that matters. It's literally about how we think about that knowledge, how we come to know that actually shapes our findings and then shapes the implications of our findings. Mm. So for me to be able to think about trans-infused methodologies and trans-infused epistemologies almost sets the stage for those findings that we end up, right, kind of getting through data collection and analysis. The other thing, I think the last thing that I'm really trying to think about and forward in my work, I think probably over the last 12 months and really moving into the second half of my tenure process or kind of movement towards the tenure process, is thinking about how I can get beyond paywalls, and particularly how I can get the work that I do to increase life chances for the people I'm working alongside, right? Particularly trans people who may not have access to higher education. So how can I do more public scholarship? How can I do more public engagement to be able to discuss the meaning of my work with those who are impacted through their daily lives and or might not have access because, as we know, right, there are multiple barriers to higher education.
So I'm interested because, you know, you're mentioning these sort of, I guess I pictured containers, but not necessarily, of, you know, these points of inquiry that you're engaging in. One, it sounds like, are very centered on maybe physical spaces and how those are both interacting and interfacing with transgender individuals and looking at gender as that primary lens. And then it sounds like there's another interesting area of inquiry that you're engaging in around methodologies and how we come about even researching and acquiring that knowledge. But like who we are as people asking the questions, people doing the interviewing really shapes what we'll ask and how we'll interpret it. Can you tell us if there's someone listening in who is, you know, is more leading with that practitioner lens, what would they want to know? And if someone is leading more with, you know, I'm really engaged in scholarship right now, whether I'm a grad student or that's my role, do you think that there's some top things in mind that you have found through this inquiry that you think that these folks would find interesting to know that you have found as well?
Yeah. So at first, when you use the word spaces, this always kind of piques my interest and is one of, I think, the most exciting findings from the work that I've done, and in particular from the study that I did for the Trans in College book, is that when we think about spaces on college campuses, we're usually thinking about physical locations, right? Mm-hmm. So the campus proper or particular offices or departments within that campus. What the participants and I really came to understand, though, is that there were virtual spaces that were incredibly important for students' meaning-making and world-making practices. So if we know that the gender binary is literally built into the architecture of our programs, our curricula, and our campuses, then what we can do is really think about how trans people are using virtual platforms, things like Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, avatar creation sites like Bitmoji, right, to be able to imagine different gendered possible futures for themselves, and really think about how we can meet those students there and use that as a space for gendered exploration.
That's beautiful.
I also, like, in terms of the methodological stuff, I think there are some really, I'll say, anachronistic ways of understanding the word gender, right? And actually, one of these methodological projects that I'm working on right now is a co-edited book with a colleague, where we're inviting people to really reconstitute different ways of thinking about terms that are often conflated with gender, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we're thinking about is that, like, gender often becomes synonymous with cisgender women, right? And it often becomes synonymous with this kind of binary perception of what gender ought to be. And so how can we really repurpose that and recraft that to think about various different gendered possibilities and lives, so that if we're doing something, like, let's say we're doing some work on men and masculinities, right? Which men are we talking about, right? And how might just saying men and masculinities and then creating implications for quote unquote men and masculinities not actually really be giving implications for all men, right? And so I think that's kind of the methodological piece. Like, I'm really inviting people and wanting people, myself included, to be more careful and more thoughtful about what is it that we mean and who is it that we're really kind of thinking about when we use particular words, right? Mm-hmm. Because that all has an impact on actual practice that we do, right? So if we're a theory to practice kind of field, if we're an applied field, then the assumptions that we make about words and terms and concepts shows up in the work that we do, right? So that's how I see them kind of linked, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I think of is this constant tug of war or tension that happens when we talk about, you know, transgender student retention, recruitment, and we don't have accountability pieces in place, because when we are developing those, you know, whether it's the college admissions application or the intake piece, you know, that gathers demographic information, that lens is then being transposed into the boxes, the categories, the lack of or the presence of fill in the blank, and the option to opt out, you know, of categories as well if they don't fit. And so that's something that I've been thinking a lot about lately is, you know, even taking some of what we know about, you know, our identities in research and looking at evaluation, assessment, and how we actually do that data collection in our universities and colleges. Yeah. We don't know if we're retaining trans students. We don't collect the data. And I would love it if there are, you know, folks listening in that their campus is collecting that data and they're doing it in a way that has integrity, you know, to the folks that are interacting with those forms and processes. I'd love to hear it, because I just don't know of any yet, you know?
Yeah. And I think there are a number of things that I hear from practitioners when I go to different campuses, and I'm not sure if this resonates with your experiences of talking through some of these issues with folks, but what I hear sometimes is, you know, how do I ask the gender question, right? And I have a couple of different responses to that. I mean, the first one is I kind of immediately ask back, well, do you have to ask it?
Yeah.
Right? Like I think there are certain ways that we think about asking this question as a quote unquote best practice when we actually might not need it because it might not be germane to the information that we're collecting. And so why are we asking for questions that we're not going to use the data around? Yeah. The second way that I think about it is one of my colleagues who works at Wilfrid Laurier University, Michael Woodford, I think has a really great way of asking this particular type of question. So he will list out, he'll have like a drop-down menu for a series of different gender identities. Oftentimes they're identities that he has workshopped with students or practitioners at the particular institution that he's studying at, or kind of with like experts across kind of the country or the world. And he'll have these kind of common responses, right? Quote unquote, common responses. And the question will say, I identify my gender as, right, with this drop down. And then the bottom one, instead of being other or not listed, it says, I don't see my gender identity reflected in these options. Instead, I identify my gender as, and then it's kind of a blank, right? And so there's more of a affirmation, I think, of humanity in that type of question. I think the other tricky part is on the back end, particularly for quantitative folks, how do you go about coding that and making sense of that, right?
Yeah, so. Absolutely. I know some really rad people that are doing that work within departments, and, you know, there seems to be sort of a, they're collecting it in one or more programs or at the LGBT Resource Center. And then I wonder, are institutional research and those folks, you know, really engaged at the larger campus level or a larger system level for some of our, you know, state systems or some of these other kind of collaborative group systems of higher ed. But I really would love to see that, expanded and scaled out so that it's, I don't know. I mean, you said Michael Woodward?
Woodford.
Yep. Is Michael Woodford doing that, you know, at large scale? Is it something that has kind of caught wind on the rest of the campus?
Yeah, so he is in a department of social work, and so is really looking at, he actually does some really fantastic work around scale creation, and in particular looking at things like LGBTQ microaggressions on college campuses. And I say LGBTQ, really, he does a nice job of kind of separating out like sexuality and gender. He also is the co-PI with Chris Wren on the National Study for LGBTQ Student Success that is continuing. And so he is kind of doing some, I think, really nice work around how it is that we can go about collecting some of this data and how we can create larger data sets. I am curious to see if in a couple of years, right, if this will actually make an impact in terms of how we're collecting data through like the National Study for Student Engagement, right? I mean, NESE still has gender and sexuality as a quote unquote, an optional thing that you can add. I think HERI data, SERP data, IPEDS data, right? These are all kind of very big data sets that wouldn't it be great if we could do some different kinds of analysis with gender? I think that there are all of these, you know, quote unquote, perfectly logical explanations for why these data sets are not doing that type of work. But yeah, I'm hopeful that maybe this will kind of catch fire a little bit.
I love it. Thanks for, you know, I was kind of just interested in kind of going that route. And this question is, you can interpret it as you feel like, you know, does justice to your experience. How did you arrive to the work that you're doing today? Tell us about that path.
I think part of this really has to start with my practitioner experience. You know, I first had kind of this real interest in gender, mainly thinking about, I think the phrase that I was using years ago, and some people still use this phrase, is like thinking about alternative masculinities. Some people talk about like healthy masculinities, right? There are all these kind of terms that may be problematic in various different ways, but I was thinking about masculinities and expanding notions of masculinities. I, at the time, identified as a pretty effeminate, right, gay man. And this is, you know, in my early practitioner days, as well as, you know, then kind of morphing to think about not just being gay, but queer and what that really means, both I think politically and for my own personal identity. I really then focused on sexual violence prevention and thinking about how we can get cisgender men involved in sexual violence prevention. And always kind of thought about myself in terms of just being super queer, right? And I think that's mainly because I didn't have the language for trans. You know, I didn't have the language for trans until I started meeting some trans people, until I started also allowing myself to even think about the possibility that I might be trans. I remember this time when I was watching TV on a weekend. I was watching Hulu, you know, and Hulu always plays those same commercials over and over and over again. And it was, so this was like the umpteenth time I'd seen this super cute commercial for, I think it was like Tide, right? It was some kind of detergent. Maybe I'll get a kickback from Tide based on this. But it was a commercial with this cute little girl, and she was trying on all these different kinds of tights and like dancing around in her room and checking herself out in the mirror. And it said something like, if you want your whites brighter, or your whites whiter and your brights brighter, you should use Tide, right? And after seeing this commercial for about the 15th time, I was like, oh my gosh, I wish I had those tights. And then I was like, oh shit, I wish I had those tights.
Uh-huh.
And like, what the fuck does that mean? Right. And I'm living in Arizona, which like was not a great state to be different in at the time, nor really is it now in some respects. Right. And so then I remember calling my friend Chase, who's a trans man, very dear colleague of mine. And I said, Chase, I think I'm trans and I really don't know what to do about it. Right. And for me, the people that I knew, right, Chase and other people that I knew were biomedically transitioning. Right. And so I was like, is that what it means for me to be trans? I just didn't know. And Chase encouraged me to read. He said, you know, I know that you make sense of your world through reading. Here are some books, try and find yourself in them. And through that process, I really came into my own trans community, which started out as a literary community. And then I moved to start my doctoral work and was able to find a human community. Yeah. And so that's kind of how I arrived at like broadly my work. I think right now how I come to my future research projects is by really thinking about, so I consider myself a critical pedagogue and a critical theorist. So I really think through larger systems of inequity and how they shape our worlds. And so I think about what are the most pressing issues and who are the most vulnerable populations within the trans community. And so for me right now, I'm trying to craft some work that will focus on trans women of color and their experiences in educational contexts. Because as we know, trans women of color continue to be harmed, harassed, and quite literally violently erased. And so that's kind of where I'm getting towards in terms of my current work projects.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I love that that was a natural segue into the next question, which is about those resources that you would recommend to others, including, you know, books, podcasts, the things that those bodies of work that influence the way that you approach your work today and who you are in this work. So what are those resources that you would share with other folks that they might enjoy?
Yeah, so I've been talking a little bit to some folks about this idea that I call courting difference. And I think when we read books and when we listen to podcasts, I really encourage people to stretch beyond themselves. I think it's really easy and kind of comfortable for us to see ourselves in the media and the literature that we consume. And I really try to move beyond myself and kind of court all sorts of difference, right? So recently I've been doing a lot of reading around Indigenous methodologies and Indigenous studies. I think the work of Adrienne Keene, who operates, really kind of organizes the blog Native Appropriations, is a fantastic resource. Heather Schotten, Amanda Tashin, Stephanie Waterman in our field of higher ed have been doing some brilliant, brilliant work around Indigenous methodologies and Indigenous student populations. I also have been really trying to think about kind of broader cultural discourses around race and ethnicity. So podcasts like See Something, Say Something, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, Code Switch, Still Processing are things that I really love. I just finished Angela Davis's latest book with one of my classes, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, which I think is a really lovely book. Anyone who follows me on Twitter knows that I have a love obsession with Sarah Ahmed's work too. And so I think that On Being Included is a must read for everyone in higher ed. So yeah, I mean, I think those are kind of a smattering of different things. I also think, and I will just kind of make this one plug, I think that we talk about being interdisciplinary in higher education, both research-wise as well as practitioner-wise, but we don't actually really do that very well. And so what are the ways that we can think beyond our field, right?
Yes.
And I mean everything down to like some of the students that I work alongside of like don't listen to the news regularly, right? So how can we listen to podcasts that are like less than 30 minutes, like Up First or The Daily, right? To just get those like chunks of news in the morning that we need to be thinking about that are not higher ed specific, but will inform our practice as practitioners and scholars.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, you know, when we're socialized into this field, we are socialized into the mindset that it is interdisciplinary, this work of supporting students doing higher education work. It's pulls from all these different disciplines. And in practice, I agree with you. It's like, what does that even look like? Are we talking with social workers? Are we talking with healthcare professionals and folks doing, you know, grassroots organizing? How can that work inform how we're doing, you know, the work today? And I think that it happens informally, you know, because I can think of a lot of people that are grassroots organizers that are in higher education.
Yep.
And that's their community. And I'm thinking, okay, yeah, it's great when we can infuse those sort of experiences and the practices and the models. And then how is that scaled out? You know, does it just kind of happen by happenstance or, I don't know. I appreciate you sharing all those. So we're going to list all those in the show notes, and the show notes for every episode are going to be resilientcampus.com/14, since this is episode 14. So folks can find that link and then just click through on all the amazing readings and podcasts that Z just mentioned. So Z, we're kind of switching gears here a little bit. What has been the biggest lesson that you've learned in your professional life?
So the biggest lesson that I have learned has been about cultivating cultivating kin, right? And I learned this from my participants first and foremost, for the book project that I did. These nine trans students, you know, I mean, they are just an amazing group of people, who I'm fortunate to still be in touch with several of them. You know, I went in thinking that I would be studying community, but didn't really think much about building community, right? And the reality that I would build lifelong community with some of these folks. And I think they're the ones who really taught me about the importance of developing what we ended up calling kinship networks. And as I've moved through my professional career, I've realized that the times that were most difficult are when I felt furthest away from my kin or felt like I didn't have kin. And the times when I felt most rejuvenated and refreshed are when I was surrounded by the love and the support of the people that are nearest and dearest to me, right? Like the people who are champions for me, who are checking in on me and are reflecting the types of love that I was giving to them. And so, you know, I hear often, especially from doctoral students, that the academy can be a really lonely place. And I think it certainly can be, right? I think whether we are professionals, whether we're practitioners or scholars or scholar practitioners, the idea for creating an organizational unit is not to always have everyone be the same, right? Sure, we may share some identities, right? And especially when we think about scholars, we want all sorts of different kinds of expertise and all sorts of different kinds of people. And that can be really great, but it also can be really lonely, right? I think especially when we talk about minoritized and marginalized people, we often feel like, and we often are, the only one, right? And that can be deeply problematic. And so that then creates this sense of isolation and this sense of fear and the sense of just precarity. Right. And so how can we, again, move beyond just physical locations and physical campuses to create kinship, to create these what I call microclimates of love and support that can nurture and sustain us in what we know is a really unhealthy place.
And what does that look like in developing and maintaining kinship networks?
Yeah. So for me, it means being attentive to my phone. I know that's going to sound really weird, right? But like not everyone is in DeKalb with me. And so I'm actually someone who's very aware of my phone, is texting people, is calling people. I use my car trips, right, to check in with folks. I am someone who believes in scheduling time with friends and that being a really important thing. Skyping with people. It also means being intentional about like writing notes and letters, actually getting things in the mail, which like I've fallen off a little bit on, right, but have tried to be good about. I think it also means knowing that when I feel depleted, that I can go back to virtual spaces where I know I will get affirmed, right? So like I can use my Instagram account to show up in ways that I want to and feel like I actually can't in physical space and know that I will get a lot of double taps and feel affirmed in who I am and how I'm living my life. You know, I think some of those are the really important things to really consider about like using all of these virtual spaces in order to kind of maintain our friendships and yeah.
I love that you mentioned that last piece about, you know, Instagram, and I know you're active on Twitter. Because I probably couldn't even count them, the number of days where I've seen a post from you and I'm just like real giddy about it. And it just lights up my day to see, you know, to see you just in your fullness, like whatever that means for you in that moment, in that day, and whatever you want to share out with the world. It just makes me really happy and giddy.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, it, similarly, me with you, right? Like I love these quotes that you post every week, right? Like when I feel really depleted, I know that I'm going to see something right from Resilient Campus. And it's just going to be this beautiful kind of uplifting comment. And even just this past weekend, right? I was visiting my partner and we were just kind of hanging out, and all of a sudden just out loud, right? I just said, Oh my gosh, all the trans women that I know on Instagram are so intensely beautiful, right? Like my feed was just full of these beautiful trans women who are posting selfies and posting pictures. And I'm like, oh my gosh, my community is so rich and so vibrant and so lovely. And I think that we sometimes kind of badmouth social media and don't really think about all of the generative things that it can do and that it gives to us, right?
I appreciate that. 'Cause I've been a part of a lot of conversations recently with folks who are taking, a hiatus or disconnecting their social media accounts altogether or just selective ones and talking, and I think it's a whole conversation about what makes sense for people. I love that you mentioned, you're phone attentive, you're attentive to your phone, and that is a source of generative, relationships, and for others it's like a source of anxiety, and that's not, being present with them. And so I think there's a wide spectrum on which people are having conversations about this. And there's just this beautiful, mixed generational, perspective and conversation happening where, I think although, we could critique sort of how a lot is placed on the millennials or, the current generations that we think are born with technology and what that means. But I appreciate you allowing us to reshift our focus on, well, how is it generative? How is it building community and kinship networks? And I love
And I
that.
mean, like clearly it's always a both and, right? Like, like on Saturday, right, when I was with my partner, like we were going on a hike and we were kind of leaving, and she said, "Do you have your phone? Do you want your phone?" And I was like, "No, I'm going on a hike with you. Like, what am I going to do?" Right. So there are certainly times, right, when we can unplug or doing like a social media hiatus, right, that can actually be really restorative for us. And also, right, it can also be great, right? So trying to think about this both and rather than like an either or situation.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. So Z, what's one piece of guidance that you would give to other professionals doing this work in higher ed environments?
I think one of the most important things that I would encourage professionals to do is to create unconventional partnerships. I think that we, and I was guilty of this too as a practitioner. I got really used to the people that I would work with semester after semester, term after term, year after year, and didn't really think about unconventional partnerships that I could have created and that we could have done some really cool stuff with, right? So I'm thinking about like, oh, what have I been talking about lately with some folks? Creating like a queer closet. I know that some folks have like this queer closet that they create where they basically, it's like a clothing donation site as well as a place where queer and trans people can go and get clothes because shopping tends to be a really hard experience for many of us. So how can we make that safer? How can we make it more affordable? I'm also wondering, like, what are ways then that queer centers might be able to partner with career services, might be able to partner with Disability Resource Center, right? Might be able to partner with a women's center to think about all of the various populations that also have a hard time shopping. Might be able to partner with International Student Services, might be able to partner with Res Life in order to find some space to have the closet. Might be able to partner with people who are doing food pantry stuff on campus to think about creating access to a space where it is private and confidential and still accessible regularly for people. I think there are so many different ways that we can create unconventional partnerships. I've been talking with people too about people who work in rec and wellness, saying, we do these like women's fitness classes. How can we open those up? And so how can maybe queer folks and people doing queer research and people doing work around queer practitioner stuff on campus really think about how do we broaden notions of womanhood? How do we work with instructors of these classes so that we're not just advertising expansive notions of womanhood, but we're also talking with the instructors to give them the capacity to interrupt gender policing if they see it in their classes, right? Which I think is another unconventional partnership, right? When I was thinking about queer work on campus, I certainly was not thinking about rec and wellness, right? So I think that that can be great. I also think the other thing you mentioned is I think about unconventional partnerships even extending beyond campuses. There are people who have been doing grassroots work and organizing for decades, and this work is like brilliant, amazing, but we're just not using that work and tapping into these folks, right? And so I think that there are so many people that we should be working alongside of so that we don't have to keep on recreating the wheel, that I think could be really great and really are kind of location specific, right? So like for you being in the Twin Cities, I know there are particular people in that area that are fantastic, right? But I'm not sure that they're being utilized to their fullest.
Absolutely. I think one of the things I realized early on in being in, student affairs roles specifically was that some of our policies within the institution really make it difficult, if not impossible, sometimes to even host a grassroots group or organization on the campus. And I'll, one example that I think of was we had a group that was doing local group that was doing anti-racism training, and they wanted a community space. And we're like, as a university, we have fantastic facilities. And there was a policy put in place where they needed $1 million in insurance to be in and have tax status as an organization to then be able to be on the campus. And I thought, we have to really examine all of these things. Are there is it just this locked in policy that needs to be in place? Like, is it so rigid that we can't really host an anti-racist, organization looking to move their vision forward? Because, space is a commodity, physical space. And especially here in the Twin Cities, it's a conversation that we have quite often that there's not currently a space for queer and trans people of color, since, our local coffee shop that was run by two amazing folks. It's hard to sustain a business model, especially with these multiple identities. And now they're like, we don't have a space. And so physical space is something that we're constantly in conversation about and needing. And I wonder how we can work to really examine those policies and practices to really be able to break down the walls between the campuses and our communities. And it, and I think people are doing it really well. I've seen some really rad practices, and I've seen administrators say, well, I can just clear that right away. I can just sign and say that we will, have some sort of loophole for this. And sometimes it takes that one person. I don't know
Well,
if
and
that.
that's and that seems to me to be the work that is so deeply connected to exposing and interrogating white supremacy and settler colonialism, right? Like this idea about property and who owns property, right, is deeply invested in colonial logics. And so to think differently about that, to think about how we can think more collectively rather than individualistically, I think it is a part of the work, right? A lot of people might say, oh, well, this is like ancillary or it's not really what student affairs is about. Oh, no. Like, this is the work because it seeps into everything that we do, right? And it changes who we can quite literally be in community with, as you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh God, there's so much there. I think, Anyway, so
That's a whole different episode, right? Like,
I had the honor of going to this Women of Color Summit that was run at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and they just did a phenomenal job. Anitra and team, like, I just am in awe of them. And one of the speakers who's local here, Sasane, was saying that it was really, for me, for the first time, and I feel a little embarrassed to say this, as someone that has been critically thinking about how higher education wasn't built for, for women. It wasn't built for queer and trans people. It wasn't built for people of color, right? Like, and this was the first time that I had ever heard anyone say that the concept of a land grant institution is in itself this, at the root of it, white supremacy is, remnant of this settler colonialism, and really, like, whose land was it to give away anyways? And for me, I was just like, wow, I feel embarrassed that I never thought about that. And here I am, talking about land grant institutions, and I don't know that I've been a part of a conversation until a few weeks ago at this summit where that was brought up.
Yeah, I mean, that's a word, right? Like, because when we do learning about the history of higher education, we always talk about the more a land grant acts as like this beneficent thing, right? Without thinking about kind of the undergirding, right, structure that you're talking about. Yeah, that's some deep shit. So.
It is deep. And it's like, yes, because I feel like when we talk about land grants, we talk about the public engagement piece, which a lot of us in higher ed are that's just how we do the work. You know, it's we don't inherently acknowledge those walls or those gates or the tower, you know, if you will, the ivory tower. We're sort of, you know, really a broad sweeping understanding of community. And so I was really interested to, I think what it does allow us in that classification is it allows us to make central the public engagement, you know, goal or purpose. And I hadn't seen it yet coupled with that historical context. And for me, it wasn't like I didn't know that land was, you know, stolen from Native folks. I just never connected it. And I think, you know, part of that is the ongoing work and that, you know, even as a person of color, as a queer person of color, like I still have my work to do. And so even though I'm embarrassed to say it, I'm like, yeah, I'm still learning and I'm still open to being wrong and to being surprised and to getting information I didn't know before, because I'm okay with that. And just, what am I going to do with it now is my
question. Exactly. Yeah.
Anyways. So Z, always lovely to engage with you.
So good. Yeah.
So as we close out, is there anything else that you wanted to share with folks listening in? Because I just know that I really enjoy what you put out in the world. And if there's anything that's on your mind that you want to share out before we close this episode.
You know, I think the one thing that I'm wrestling with these days is, you know, how we can take risks. I've been asking people this question and doing a lot of reflection on this question myself about, like, what are we willing to give up in the name of justice, particularly for people with, yes, various marginalized identities, but also a lot of privilege in the academy, right? For someone who, myself, right, I'm white, I have a terminal degree, right? Like I tell people regularly that I make more than enough to do the work that I do, right? To do a job that I actually love doing. And so I think it's incumbent upon me and other folks in higher ed, be they practitioners or scholars, to really think about what we're willing to give up. And I don't mean this in kind of a savior complex kind of way, but what are we willing to give up to be with and alongside the people who we are working with and striving with towards liberation, right? So are you willing to give up space? Are you willing to give up time? Are you willing to give up energy? Are you willing to give up getting everything checked off your to-do list for a day? Are you willing to give up some energy that maybe you would use to, you know, like sleep a little bit, particularly for people with dominant identities, right? Like, what does it mean to show up for me as a white person to deconstruct white supremacy in the name of racial justice, right? And not to do it for a plaque or a badge or an award, but to do it because I know that my liberation is tied up with the liberation of people of color, and that people of color face, again, asymmetrical, right, violences and threats. So I think that's one of those big questions that I've been kind of wrestling with myself. And I think similar to what you just shared, like I'm coming to some potentially unsettling kind of realities about how I've operated and really thinking about how I can change some of that moving forward. And also engaging in some really good conversations about what other people are thinking about in relation to that question.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. Do you have as you've come to realize, and sort of wrestle with those things that are unsettling in your own personal practice, have you found strategies that are helpful for you to work through those rather than working around them or sort of leaning away from them?
Yeah, I think for me, part of the way that I process is to sometimes get away from my desk. Right. And sometimes I find that moving my body is actually really helpful for thinking through things. So when I'm on my bike, I'm able to focus on one idea and kind of process through it. When I take walks, I'm able to do that as well. I think it's because I do so much kind of just stationary kind of sitting or writing or thinking that to move my body actually gets me to think a little bit differently. I also think sometimes just like having a sleep or two away from an idea, right, allows me to come back to it in a more refreshed kind of way. As millennial, right, I tend to want to do things very quickly. And so I've learned to kind of resist that and take a little mini break before I come back to certain things. And also to have accountability buddies, right, who hold me accountable to coming back, right, to that idea. I think it could be really easy for me with some of my dominant identities to kind of not address some of the ugly realities that I'm both invested in propping up as well as invested in dismantling. Mm-hmm. And so these are the kinds of things that I kind of lean on my kin for to be like, hey, just a reminder, right? Like, what are you thinking about with this? So that I can be accountable to myself and to them.
I love that. Thank you. I feel like I gleaned at least two more things that I really want to integrate into my practice. I think sleeping on it is a big one for me.
Yeah.
And not just because of the way I process information, although my partner calls me deliberate because I'm just a little mm-hmm. more slower in how I process and take in information yeah. and am able to regurgitate that out for something that feels useful in the world.
Yeah.
But I appreciate you saying even one or two sleeps away from.
Yep. Yep.
That's great. Yeah. As many yeah. as it takes.
Exactly.
Great. And Z, how can folks connect with you so that they can add you to their network?
Yeah. So like you had mentioned earlier, I like Twitter a lot. So I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is trans_killjoy. So folks can add me there. I also have a website. So it's znicolazzo.weebly.com. I just need to pay for the actual site to get rid of the Weebly part. But for now, right, znicolazzo.weebly.com. I have a contact page as well as a blog that I update quasi-regularly. I actually just released the first guest blog post on a curated series called Living and Loving Trans yesterday by actually my partner, Lauren Irwin. And so that's a way that people can kind of keep in touch with what I'm doing and how things are going. But yeah, the contact page also kind of goes right to my personal email, and that can be a way that people can kind of touch base and talk through stuff.
Great. So I think what I'll do is I will not only link your contact information, I'm going to link the link to that most recent blog post that you put out, because I just started reading it and I was loving it. So I hope that other people do too. I believe it was about trans, non-trans relationships. Was that?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. So Lauren created a listicle of 12 questions to ask in a trans, non-trans relationship. And if folks are interested in contributing to that series, there's, you know, I have some guidelines that are also posted on my blog that people can contribute just to kind of think about, like, you know, community knowledge, right? Like, I know that there are a lot of things that people are thinking about that I'm not. And so, I'd love if people want to contribute.
Fun. Okay, great. Thank you so much. Yeah. So Z, we're closing out. Thank you so much for being with us today. I love that you brought these two very inspirational quotes into our world. And I'd love it if it came from you.
Yeah, sure. So the first one is from Audre Lorde. People might be familiar with this, but Audre Lorde said, "There is no such thing as a single issue struggle because we do not live single issue lives," which I think is always an important reminder for me, right? And inspires me to think again beyond myself and thinking about courting difference. And then the second quote is from Raina Gossett, who is a wonderful, rad, Black trans woman, activist and archivist. And she says, "I believe dependency is one of our greatest sources of power." And really thinking about how we can depend on each other and lean on each other, particularly in hard times, has been something that has been very moving for me, especially over the last 12 to 18 months.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Z. To all those listening in, thank you so much for all that you do. I truly appreciate you. Stay resilient. Thanks so much for tuning in. Head on over to iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss out on a single episode.